Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Whether you realize it or not, about one in every three hospital patients are accidentally harmed while in the hospital in the United States. These risks include things like hospital-acquired infections, blood clots, falls and fractures, and medication and surgical errors. Today's guest, Karen Curtis, is working to help patients learn how they can also help prevent medical accidents. Karen is a vigorous national advocate for prevention of medical errors, and this occurred to her after her father passed away due to a preventable medical error following a lung transplant. If you've got questions or comments during today's program, you can reach us in a number of ways. Our local number is 550-8433. Let me give you that one again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, and you spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Karen, it's a pleasure to have you on Line 1. How are things? You're back in Chicago, I guess, doing this by telephone.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here today.
And you're going to be up in Alaska soon, and I haven't had an opportunity. You're going to do some programs, some education about what our topic today?
Yes. Actually, I'm coming up to I'm in Chicago, so I'm flying northwest, and will be there next week to speak to a conference on infection prevention. And it's a variety of healthcare providers who are all intensely interested in helping to prevent the number one most common hospital hazard, and that is hospital infections.
So actually, the more you learn about it, the more scary it kind of gets. So we need to really do and as much as we can about that particular problem. Let's just get going a little bit and ask, if you don't mind, and I'm sure on these programs where you get interviewed, you're asked this all the time, but to tell us a little bit more, flesh out a little bit more how you got involved in helping prevent hospital-acquired problems.
I became involved a few years ago when my father was diagnosed with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a terminal condition for which there isn't even any treatment. The only cure is a lung transplant. Every year, about 40,000 people are diagnosed with IPF, and only about 400 or 1% ever get a life-saving lung transplant. Despite those odds, my father and I were determined that he was going to be one of those survivors. And together, we petitioned 16 different transplant centers. And we were so grateful, incredibly grateful, as you can imagine, when the very number one transplant center in the world accepted him as a candidate for a lung transplant. We felt like we had obviously won, probably the greatest lottery in life there ever could be. But the second lottery win came when just 3 days after he was listed for a lung transplant and he had been approved by United Network for organ sharing, a lung became available. And the reason why this was another miracle is because the average wait for a lung transplant is about 18 months. And at the time of approval, he had only maybe 6 to 8 weeks to live. It was a long shot, but we were optimistic, and we were fighters, and we were determined. And when he came out of his 9-hour transplant surgery and his pulmonologist declared him, really in great shape for someone who had been through so much and predicted that he would be on the golf course within a few months again, we thought the worst was over and that he was facing a new lease on life. He was 71 years young and had always been very active and athletic, and he was looking forward to a nice retirement. However, he took a fall one day. He had been walking in the morning, as all patients are encouraged to do, and came back to his room, and a nurse assisted him into the bathroom, but left him there. And obviously, you know, she had so many other patients to take care of, so she probably thought to herself, okay, he's in a good, safe place. I'll just leave him here. And he got tired of waiting for her to come back and thought, you know, as most of us would think, well, I'll just walk back to the bed by myself. He took a fall because his blood pressure was a little bit low that day, and he had been, and actually his oxygen saturation rate was a little bit on the low side too. So he took a fall out of dizziness, and he hit his head on something, on a bed rail, and a goose egg raised on his forehead. So just to be on the safe side, they ordered an MRI for him immediately, which came back as inconclusive. So they wanted, his doctor wanted him to be seen by a neurologist. And this was happened on a Friday afternoon about 3 o'clock. So they put him in horizontal traction until a neurologist could come up and see him, just to make sure that there hadn't been any spinal cord injury of any kind. And he was promised, and my mother was there too, that the neurologist would come to evaluate with him within a couple of hours, just as a precaution. And by dinner, he would probably be up and about again. Well, dinner on Friday night came and went, and in fact, breakfast and lunch and dinner the following day came and went, and then breakfast, lunch, and dinner came again on Sunday, and nobody had been in to see him, despite our repeated pleas. And I was calling from Chicago at the time. They were on the East Coast at a major medical center, and it wasn't until Sunday night when I called the nurse's station, really quite livid, I have to say, demanding that Dad's doctor be called at home and that something be done, a neurologist finally came in to see Dad. And the reason why this was so critically important is that anyone who has any kind of lung conditions whatsoever should never be in a horizontal position. Fluids can accumulate and cause pneumonia. And that's exactly what happened. He was in the ICU with raging pneumonia by Monday morning. And from there, in the ICU, people are not permitted to walk, even if they feel up to it. So he wasn't getting around. And while in the ICU, he developed blood clots. And again, on a Friday afternoon, they decided to take a wait-and-see about whether or not they should try to break up the blood clot or insert a mesh stent to prevent it from going to his heart or lungs. And by the following Monday, a blood clot had traveled to his brand-new lung and lodged in the lower right lobe. So he continued on in the ICU, and in the ICU, as you well know, there's a fairly high incidence of hospital-acquired infection, also known as staph infection more commonly, and sure enough, Dad ended up with MRSA. And then after that, because he had been taking so many antibiotics to combat the MRSA and his immune system was so compromised, he ended up with another horrible hospital-acquired infection, and that's called C. diff. And that really pummeled him. He fought back every single time, but he eventually did succumb after he was supposed to be in the hospital for 6 months. I mean, I'm sorry, 6 weeks to recover and then go into physical therapy. But he ended up passing away in the hospital, never having left after 7 months, basically just trying to recover from each setback. That all started with a fall that really, didn't get prompt attention. Mm-hmm. So after those 7 months, and we buried Dad, and I was determined to try and figure out what had happened. Shortly thereafter, about 2 months later, my husband entered our local community hospital for routine surgery or bowel resection. And this is a long story that I won't go into, but he ended up nearly dying himself. It was supposed to be a 5-day recovery, and he ended up with sepsis and a VRE infection, from which it took him about 18 months to fully recover. But he lived. Mm-hmm. Five. Mm. So our family has been wonderfully healthy. We had never, ever had any experience with the medical system whatsoever. We went into the hospital with all the faith and the hope and the trust and very, very strong beliefs that in both cases, even despite my dad's experience, which we kind of thought it was just had to be a fluke, it had to be bad luck. But when some of the same things were happening to my husband, it began to feel more like a pattern than bad luck. And it was after that that I decided to try to figure out, you know, what happened and what I might have been able to do as his advocate. Mm. Because, you know, we all follow this conventional wisdom that if you're ever going to the hospital, bring someone with you. But when you're that someone, and you don't have a clue what to do, what to say, what to look for, it is a terrible, terrible feeling. And I have to tell you, the guilt is real.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the therapy was really, I had been trained, I had a very long career in market research, and I thought, you know what, I'm good at digging for information. I'm going to figure out how I could have made a difference. And I went back to nursing textbooks to find out more about each of these conditions and what the standards of care were and how nurses are trained to prevent them. Because nurses really, you know, they're your buddies in the hospital. And you can see how hard they work. And I could see, especially after learning more about everything that is so important to preventing for infection, for example, and really how little time they have to do all of the things that are required to prevent infection or falls or bed sores. Dad actually ended up with a stage 4 bed sore because they just didn't have the time. They were focused on so many other things in his care that the bed sores kind of got short shrift. But they're short on time, and families who sit bedside, if they just know what to do, they can pitch in and help. And it should be okay for nurses to ask for that help as well. So that's my story.
Yeah, well, it happens
a lot.
Right. Yeah, and I know it would be nice to get some more of those statistics, but before we do that, let me ask you.
Oh, I have them.
I want to come back to those, but I want you to continue your story. You're very good at talking about it. So what was the next step? What did you do then that has brought you to where we are now with your efforts to help patients advocate for themselves and protect themselves once they go in the hospital?
Well, I think the first thing that I did, quite honestly, is I learned to speak up in very practical ways. When my husband was recovering from his experience in the hospital, our son, I had to take him to the emergency room one morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning of a Memorial Day weekend, because he had horrendous pain. He was only 9 years old, and he had terrible pain in his stomach, and I asked him to walk around the house and then walk around the parking lot of the emergency room. And just to be on the safe side, I thought, I need to have a doctor see him. But I was a little bit concerned, obviously, about taking him into a hospital, yet I didn't want to take any chances. So the doctor there prescribed for him an emergency appendectomy, even though his films did not show an enlarged appendix. So I wavered in giving consent, and I wanted to ask more questions, and he really didn't want to answer my questions. He just kept saying, you know, if he were my son, he would be in surgery. You know, why are you hesitating? But the number one learning that I learned with my husband's surgery is that there's no such thing as routine surgery. For my husband's surgery, we never got a second opinion because his doctor kept saying, oh, this is routine. It's no big deal. You don't need a second opinion. Well, in that case, in the emergency room with my son and the doctor telling me it's routine surgery, I remembered there's no such thing. I need a second opinion. So I asked for an ambulance to take him to a children's hospital. I wanted him to be seen by a pediatrician. And they were not happy with me about that at all. In fact, the doctor was screaming at me on the way out of the hospital as they were taking my son. But it was important to trust your gut, to speak up, to get a second opinion, and to do what it takes to really sometimes go against what maybe medical professionals want you to do, but you know your patient best, you know your loved one best. And ideally, it should be in the form of a conversation. Ideally, a doctor should never scream at you. But in that case, it really did make a lot of sense to take Alex to a specialist. At the children's hospital, he was examined in an entirely different way. And as it turned out, a few hours later, we were sitting at Starbucks. And I treated him to a chocolate chip frappuccino, which was his favorite. And in that case, it was just a virus that was going around. So those were really important, and that was the sort of the seed of knowing that I was on the right path, that it was up to me, and this is what I think of for everybody, is that we have a very low level of healthcare literacy in this country. And that it's up to us to learn as much as we can, and to know it's okay to ask questions and to keep asking questions until you get some answers that make sense to you. And it's okay to keep up the conversation and until everyone feels good about the plan of care. So.
But you've progressed dramatically to producing for patients checklists, information, things to arm themselves with, so that they can advocate and help in the hospital prevent the situations like happened to your husband and your father and your son.
Exactly. So I started with surgery. And the first checklist that I created were the kinds of questions to ask when if surgery has been recommended, how to get a second opinion, why it's so important to bring someone with you, and ways to prepare for surgery once it's been prescribed and you feel comfortable that that's the plan of care that you need to pursue. For example, a lot of people don't know that if you shower or with chlorhexidine soap, also commonly known as Hibiclens, for 3 days before surgery, that your chance of getting an infection are reduced significantly. That's a very small thing that can make a very big difference. Also, a lot of people don't realize that to keep warm, as you're preparing to go into surgery, helps to protect the immune system. So a lot of surgical suites are kind of on the chilly side, and there's no shame in asking for that extra blanket. Better yet, to have someone with you who helps, you know, by getting blankets from you from the blank. Going to get the blankets from the blanket warmer and reminding nurses that, you know, you could be chilled and to take care of you. Also, everybody needs to remember that you need a prophylactic antibiotic about an hour before surgery. So all of these little things that if you're aware of them as a patient, or if your care partner, your loved one who goes with you, is aware of them, more heads are better than one. And if you can collaborate with your care team and you all have the same information, then you're far more likely to get those better outcomes that everybody wants. But we have to do our homework. And that's what I've done for everybody. Because this information is out there, but I've just distilled information from so many different sources into these checklists that are written at the sixth grade literacy level, because we're all usually pretty stressed in the healthcare crisis. So I created them to be very easy to read, very quick, in the form of checklists. And I put them in my book, Safe and Sound in the Hospital. So that's
right.
A contribution, along with checklists to help prevent the most common hospital-acquired conditions, like infections and falls and other things that we were talking about.
And it's very easily available. I'm going to have you tell us how we can get the checklist, and we'll talk about the checklist a little bit more in depth. But let me take a second just to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. My guest is Karen Curtis, who has just helped us understand her dedication to trying to do what she can to decrease hospital-acquired medical problems. If you've got questions or comments or experiences you want to share, our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Karen, share with us also the rest of the information. What do we know about the numbers of problems that are happening? How do we know those numbers? Who all is working towards helping this besides yourself?
The data that you cited, the statistic that you mentioned in your introduction, that one out of three patients will be accidentally harmed by what we would call, I guess, medical error. Although I have to say that I really dislike the term medical error, because to me, in our English language and the way we use that, it's such a blaming statement. And I think I like to believe, and I do believe, just based on all of the interactions with all of the doctors and nurses that I've come across over the years, is that everybody is so well intentioned. If anything, I prefer to call them hospital hazards.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that happen in the hospital just by the very fact that you are, for example, in an unfamiliar environment, compromised by illness. That's a fall. Any unfamiliar environment, whether it's a hotel room or a hospital room, is going to cause anyone to be a little bit, at risk for a fall, and those that are compromised by illness even more so. And where it becomes a real hazard in hospitals is because of, obviously medications, lack of sleep, disorientation by, some of those medications, and just not enough hands on deck. If patients could have one person, one nurse with them all the time, perfect, but they don't, and that would be, that's just not reasonable or affordable. So that's why patients need their care partners, their family members and friends who are with them and who can, if they're not able-bodied themselves, for example, to help their loved ones back and forth to the bathroom or out for, walks or even just to, get around the room a little bit, then they can get help for their loved one, because nurses cannot be on standby. So I guess that's where, these hospital hazards that crop up, it's more because of the hospital environment and the systems in the hospital that can sometimes work against the most efficient use of nursing time. So that's really, and the same goes for medication errors, of course, as you know, are rampant. The statistics on that are not good. It's not super well documented because reporting systems for capturing this data differ by state, so we really don't have a good handle nationally on what the prevalence is of these hospital-acquired conditions or hospital hazards. But we do know that medication errors can range from giving a patient the wrong medication, one that's intended for someone else, for example, all the way to an example where the patient gets the medication, but it's 2 or 3 hours late. That's considered, you know, in the strictest terms, an error. We know that that's something that can happen just because of the very busy nature of the hospital work. And we know that oftentimes, you know, there are crises that erupt where one patient doesn't get the attention they need, like getting a medication on time, because there's a crisis with another patient on the floor. So that's another case where family members can keep track of when their loved ones need to get their medications and in what dose. They can also watch out for potential side effects or interactions if they just know more about those medications. And there are lots of apps out there, lots of medication dictionaries, too, that patients' family members can use to keep track of things like this. So,
all right. I want to move on and perhaps get you to list a couple or several of the different checklists you have and maybe where the idea of the checklist came from, and so we can get a better feeling, and then talk about your book, Safe and Sound in the Hospital, and make sure people know where they can get them and where you're going with this idea and some of the newer thoughts that may help hospitals and patients decrease these medical hazards that you're talking about. But I do have to take a little short break. We're about halfway through the program, Karen, so hang on for just about a minute, and we'll be right back. Let me remind our listeners again, this is Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take just a very short break and continue our conversation with Karen Curtis about preventing hazardous outcomes in the hospital. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're talking today with Karen Curtis, and she's helping us understand how patients can and should be better prepared to anticipate medical hazards, especially when you're in the hospital. She's written a book called Safe and Sound in the Hospital, which has a number of checklists and tools and information to help you understand some of the potential problems that can happen and how you as a patient or a loved one who has a patient in the hospital can help prevent these things from happening. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. We're going to be here till 3 o'clock local time. After that, you may be listening between 9 and 10 on a Monday evening, and that's a taped rebroadcast. And remember, you can always go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Line 1 link in our archives and listen to the program at any time or any of our past programs as well. So, Karen, thanks very much again for being here. Tell us a little bit more about the book, the kinds of material that you've added to it, and then maybe we'll have time to get into one or two of those checklists in a little bit more depth.
Okay. The number one hospital-acquired condition or hazard that every care provider, doctors and nurses, are most concerned about is infection. Hospitals are public places, and germs are everywhere. Hospital cleaning staff, they do their best to decontaminate surfaces, but they're high-touch areas, that bed rails, for example, and phones and cell phones and remotes and call buttons, and virtually every area of the hospital comes into human contact, and bugs are spread everywhere, even on nurses' uniforms, because bugs, and I mean that, you know, germs, meaning travel. I don't mean, you know, creepy crawly things, but hospital germs are transported on fabrics and on stethoscopes and blood pressure cuffs. And those kinds of things are really tend to be kind of super resistant. They're the bugs and germs in hospitals that have survived all kinds of antibiotics. So doctors and nurses are very worried that patients will get MRSA or C. diff or VRE, and there are some others that are even worse, that will really get in the way of recovery. So where care partners can really lend a hand is to help keep those surfaces clean. On our checklist to help prevent MRSA, for example, which is one of the most common staph infections, is if care partners simply use alcohol wipes to clean off all of those high-touch areas and then re-clean them after they're touched, that would go a long way towards minimizing what what hospital professionals call the bacterial load. The other thing, but probably the most critical thing, is to simply make sure that everyone washes their hands before touching their loved one. And it's important to speak up. We know that there are some care providers, doctors and nurses, who are resistant to the constant hand washing that's required in order to keep MRSA from spreading. But that's why it's even more important that that patients have someone with them to ask them to do that, because patients are afraid to ask. Oftentimes, if they think that a simple request like hand washing might somehow offend their care providers, it shouldn't be the case, but it is. But it's an important message. That's just one thing. Bleach wipes, for another of those horrible staph infections, and actually I don't know if it falls under the category of staph, but it's a hospital-acquired infection, and that's C. diff. Those germs can only be eliminated with bleach. So if patients' care partners would wipe all of the highly contaminated or the surfaces that are prone to being highly contaminated with bleach wipes, they can help prevent C. diff, or make sure that their loved ones always wash their hands before they eat and have a nail brush where they help them clean under their nails. That would go a long way towards helping to prevent C. diff. So there are lots of little things that add up to a big difference. And there are more. We can get into them. But there are other little things like that to help prevent blood clots and pressure wounds or bed sores and urinary tract infections, falls,
and
lots of little things.
Even you point out what days are good to have surgery and what are not such good days if you can control it. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
Let's take we do have a call. I'd like to take her call and see what she has to say. Heidi, you're on line one.
Thank you. Boy, this book sounds great. I wish I had it a couple weeks ago. I just came back from Florida, where I went down for my mom was in the hospital and ran into a lot of problems. One of the biggest being it was a holiday weekend, and the doctor that was first assigned to her was on vacation, was replaced by another doctor, who was replaced by another doctor, and she had various doctors who were supposedly overseeing her medication, and then there was this specialist and that specialist. There were so many doctors involved in her care, I felt like there was somebody who was really overlooking what was going on. And furthermore, every time, you know, I spent hours and hours and hours in the hospital room with her, but they had a way of coming in when I left for lunch or something, and I had a hard time talking to the doctors.
So that's that's a problem that I would like to see addressed a little bit as a physician. I'm very much aware that the complexity of care has gotten great. There's multiple providers. There are now hospitalists, people who just practice in the hospitals taking care of patients. So the communication is always a big issue. That sounds like what you're talking about has led to lots of head problems down in Florida with your experience.
Right. The communication and the lack of what I couldn't see good oversight. And I think she ended up staying in the hospital probably 3 or 4 days longer than she would have otherwise, which caused her to lose strength because she was tied to her IV and she couldn't get exercise.
Right.
She actually ended up going to rehab afterwards. She's still there right now regaining her strength. She's right. Lucky she'll be able to go home, but I know there's people who get in that situation and they just keep losing their strength and they never get to go home.
Right.
It's very, very scary.
Right. Karen, what are your thoughts on this situation?
I think she brought up something that's critically, critically important. She's absolutely right. And you made the point, too, there are more specialists and there are more opportunities for gaps in communication to occur as a result. Actually, specialists or non-specialists, they're just more physicians and nurses involved in care. She is absolutely right that as a family member, you are the quarterback for care. There is no one person. It's not like what, at least I might be aging myself, but I grew up with Dr. Marcus Welby. You know, he took care of everything. And in such a kind, benevolent way, and there were no worries, and he remembered everything, and that is just not, you don't have one go-to anymore who is going to coordinate care among physicians even. So it's that family member is the person who needs to do that, and the best way to do that is to take notes. That's why in my book, Safe and Sound in the Hospital, there's a section on, well, one section on how to keep track of everybody. There's sort of an organization chart where you can fill in the names and contact information of all of the doctors involved and, you know, what their roles are. But then there are pages for taking notes with prompts of the kinds of things that you need to watch for every single day and the questions you need to ask every single day. And the most important, I think, if we're just going to boil it down to one or two, is to ask every single day, what is the plan of care? What are the goals for today? And if you can get that much, you know, sorted out, I think you're way far ahead. Plus, if you take notes and you're prepared with your questions, you know, I understand what you're saying. The minute you go out and you need a sandwich because you think you're just famished and you're losing strength yourself, and to have someone come in during that time, how frustrating. I think that leaving a list of those questions for the doctor just in case you should miss him or her and to let everybody know that you've left these questions and you'd like responses to them and leave a pen for them to write them down for you. We have to think of creative ways to do things like that. But keeping good notes is huge.
All right. So we have another caller. Let's take Richard. Richard, you're on line one.
Thank you. It was like listening to everything that I went through. I was being treated for cancer in Seattle. And it seemed as though, I think the biggest problem we seem to have is that the doctors didn't seem to to speak with each other. It was as if every time I saw, you know, there was a doctor for this, a doctor for that. There was even a pain control team. And I really had problems with those people because, you know, they'd say, well, how's your pain? And I'd say, well, it's not too good. And they'd look at, I guess, maybe some sort of chart that says, here's what you're supposed to give people, you know, that's based on, I guess, an average as opposed to an individual. And, you know, they literally got belligerent with me every time I told them, that my pain wasn't good. At one point in time, they had given me one of these blocks. Nerve blocking things, the same thing they give, pregnant women. What do you call those?
Epidural.
Epidural, right. And so the guy was arguing with me that, you know, there's no way I could have pain because of the epidural. And just to prove it to me, he, you know, pulled out the bandage and the needle wasn't even in me. You know, just fell to the ground, you know. And then, of course, he apologized. But it just seemed as though they don't read each other's notes. And, you know, because they ask you this, you know, it's as though they don't talk to each other, and it's very frustrating because I don't know what to do. I mean, I'm there, you know, half awake and, you know, just trying to do my best to make it through all of these surgeries and what have you, and it's frustrated my wife to no end because it's as though they just don't talk to each other, and so I wish I would have had some sort of guide, you know, something to tell us what to do during that whole thing. But I don't know. Is this a... I guess the biggest question I have is, do doctors even bother reading your chart? It just didn't seem as though they read the chart.
Right. Yeah, Richard, I think this is a very, very critical issue. I'm not, and Karen, I'm going to make some comments, and then I'll ask you if you've addressed it, because I'm not sure that you address it, but maybe you have. But I think in the outpatient as well as the inpatient that there's a lack of this communication, and because there's multiple providers and because of time constraints, it's difficult. But there are ways around this. We've found in our office that when we get consults and information, that just allowing our nurses to summarize that and add that quickly to the chart helps us know. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head, I can appreciate exactly what you said because I've been in the hospital, I've had friends in the hospital and so forth. I understand that there are ways around this, and I still think this is a particular area that needs to be addressed a lot. Karen, your comments.
I agree, and it's and a lot of and you don't know this. I mean, in your caller's experience, you don't know until you're in the middle of it. So to share your story, I really appreciate it because now other people are going to, you know, recognize that this is a potential problem and be better prepared. In your case, it, as a patient trying to manage all of this had to be horrendous. I think that it's hard to be creative when you're in the middle of it, but if we can anticipate it, and to your idea of having nurses summarize for you, I think that's a great one. I think also when you have, and hopefully you do have a care partner with you, to have them ask for rounding, or actually shift, another common way to describe it is that shift change. Ask for shift change to be done bedside. So when doctor is coming on duty, others are leaving, nurses are changing shift, have them share their notes and listen to the notes they share with each other at the bedside. Because then if you have the chance to correct things, you have a chance to ask questions, and there will be gaps in information, too, that you can fill in at that time. And this, is again, goes back to, I know I'm harping on this a lot, of taking your notes so that you can help fill in the blanks. So that's that, at least in terms of a system, having this system of inserting yourself into the conversation, which you should be part of, at shift change is a good way to do that.
Well, thank you. You know, the only thing that got me through it really was, and I didn't ever lose my sense of humor, that's for sure, but because it was very frustrating, and I had no idea that you can ask them to, you know, to do the notes, because that's, you know, surely where the communication gets dropped.
Yeah, the notes are often written, and certainly with electronic medical records, despite a lot of sometimes angst about those, They are easily read. In the past, with written notes, it was impossible sometimes to see what a doctor was trying to say. So even if I did read it, I couldn't understand read it. So that has improved quite a lot. But we still, as physicians, of which I'm one, we need to spend more time making sure we're looking at other physicians' notes. There's no excuse for one way or the other figuring out a way that we are better prepared when we see patients. And some physicians are better than others. Let's put it out there, and you have to make an effort at it. But I think it's an extremely important thing to be addressed along with these other issues that we're talking about. Richard, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
So how do we get the book?
It is available on Amazon. Just either Google or put the search Safe and Sound in the Hospital or my last name, Curtis, Curtiss. And we have some programs going into hospitals, so it's possible that your hospital may be able to offer this to you someday, and that's our goal. Our goal is actually for hospitals to be able to disseminate this information to their patients. But we're not there yet, so in the meantime, we've got Amazon.
Well, maybe some hospital administrators, nurses, people in charge, or people who can make suggestions. Hospitals may be listening, and I couldn't help but think about a way to do this better. Once we started talking before the program, is these checklists are really an effort to help the nurses, help the hospital decrease problems, and why shouldn't hospitals provide those to patients as they come in? If a patient's in a situation where they're at risk of blood clots or falls, to have the patient's advocates in get these to go over, and it's just it's inexpensive and it's helpful, and certainly it will be, I think, beneficial. And it was nice to hear that you're already doing that. It's just a matter of getting hospitals to hear what you're producing and how they can use it.
Yes, we are going to be offering it in about a month. Our website is going up, called Partners for Care, and on a subscription basis, hospitals will be able to disseminate this information to their patients, loved ones, to their greater community. We really don't put any boundaries around how they disseminate it to their to the people they serve, and we have nursing curriculum to go along with it too, because it is a conversation. We want everyone to be prepared. We want everyone to feel comfortable about talking about these hazards without any blame.
Yeah.
Without just let's how can we work together? How can we collaborate to take care of the patients that we're supporting? So that's what we're all about.
Certainly, I think maybe it's my defensive mode because this is my profession, but there are clearly what the medical profession has done is they have begun to realize that they've got a problem because they've collected the data, they've looked at it, they realize there's a problem. There's multiple efforts by large government and private organizations to help us decrease it, as well as the professionals themselves. But this is a whole different way and seems like to have a lot of bang for its buck by making it a collaborative approach from the patient and the caregivers to work together to decrease these issues, because it makes a lot of sense, Karen.
Thank you. I think so, too. I think often of all those hours I spent bedside with my dad watching the Golf Channel, and I think about how I could have still been watching the Golf Channel with him, but also wiping down the surfaces, knowing that it was okay to ask people to wash their hands. If the nurses had said to me, look, he's at risk for a fall, we need to make sure that someone is always with him whenever he's potentially on the move, we have to have someone with him. He would be alive today. So thank you for this opportunity to help translate our families experience into something positive for others.
We have one more call. I'd like to go ahead and take that one as well. Diana, you're on line one.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was just curious if your guest has any feelings about how the medical professionals, the nurses, feel about having patient care, our patient advocate, making additional demands on their time or asking questions that may require them to take a little bit more time than they otherwise would. Are they receptive to that? What's her experience with that?
Good question.
That is a fabulous question. And I, you know, part of what I do is nursing training. And I have had sessions with nursing leaders. And I wrote another book, actually. It's called Safe and Sound Tools for Patient and Family Engagement. And there are some nurses in our workshops who won't even open the book. And they sit there, and their arms are crossed, and they won't open the book, and they won't. And I kind of understand it. They say, oh, no, this is going to take more of my time to actually share this information and to answer questions when I'm already feeling stressed. However, I don't think that they're in the majority. I think the majority really want to feel like it's okay to discuss all of these things and to share responsibilities, because ultimately that will translate into safer patient outcomes. I think that's a bigger motivation for most nurses. But you are so right. There are some that will, and they do, there was a recent study that 30% of doctors and nurses don't feel that patients or families should be entitled to ask them to wash their hands. They feel a personal affront when someone asks them to wash their hands, even though that's an emotional response, even though they know that it's the number one way to prevent infections. So there is a disconnect. And as that family member who's watching out for your loved one, it can make you feel very uncomfortable when you get that kind of response. But you have to be brave. You really do. You have to be kind and polite but firm.
Yeah, I would echo that. I don't think it's true that everybody's going to fall in line, but I think the vast majority of caregivers are just like everybody else. So we want to do the best we can. Sometimes we're harried. Sometimes we have our own personal problems. Sometimes we don't have a lot of time. But all in all, like everybody else, we're trying to do the best we can as well as we can. So I don't see a problem with trying to advocate. I also would say that as a physician, I probably respond better to people who are asking me intelligent questions and really thinking through and also sometimes reminding me about potential problems I may not have even thought about.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate this program. Thankfully, I've not been in this position, but should I get in this position at some point, I will definitely keep all of this information in mind. Thank you so much.
Okey-doke.
Well, thank you for your great question.
Jeanette, you're on line one.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Oh, hi.
I just kind of wanted to say that I am a cancer survivor, and I had all my surgeries and chemo and everything, and then through the process of the chemo, I came down with, I don't know if you come down with it or occur it or how, sepsis. And it was really hard on me. All of my family lives outside, and most of my Alaska family lives in Valdez, so it was difficult for me. It was, I was at the point where I didn't understand things, and all of my family would call and try to give me messages. It was at the point where I couldn't even hold the telephone to my ear to talk to them. It was that hard on me. But the hospital, the nursing staff, the nurses' aides, they were very good to me. getting messages back and forth to my family so far away. And then when I was stronger, I could talk to them, but, you know, myself, and tell them how I was doing physically and emotionally and everything. But I want to say a good word
okay.
to the staff at the hospital.
All right. Jeanette, thanks very much. We needed that.
Okay.
Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, Karen, we're in our last couple of minutes, and I love to end up with just some key thoughts. Also, please tell us again. People can go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and get some links to getting your book. But tell us again the name of your book and how to get it.
Safe and Sound in the Hospital, Must-Have Checklists and Tools for Your Loved One's Care, and it's on Amazon, and it's $19.95.
All right. What do we need to remember about today's program?
Okay, just top things. If you remember nothing else, as a patient, bring someone with you. It could be a loved one. It could be a friend. It could be anybody that you, I mean, you could even hire somebody. There are advocate organizations out there now, but please do bring a friend. Something to remember is that patients forget up to 80% of what their care providers tell them. So those extra pair of eyes, ears, and hands are critical. Ask that person to take notes. Things slip through the cracks, and it's important to track medications, test results, next steps. The number one thing to remember in the hospital is that infection is the number one concern, and the number one way to prevent it is as simple as washing hands. So the other is trust but verify. And finally, we didn't even talk about this, but readmissions are a big issue. 20% of patients end up in the hospital within 30 days, and a lot of them don't have to. So if you're watching out for a loved one who's leaving the hospital, mentally rehearse what their needs are going to be after the hospital stay, what their medical needs are going to be, what their daily living needs are going to be. And even if you have to go back to work, make sure that somebody is lined up to take your loved one to doctor's appointments, to get prescriptions filled, to teach them how to take their prescriptions and when, to have a good prescription, a good medication system in place, and to know what to look for. And there are some very common, we have to leave. But in any event, all of this is covered in the book.
All right. Karen Curtis, thanks very much for doing everything you're doing to help prevent medical hazards.
Well, thank you for your time and for your interest.
All right. If the listeners would like to continue the conversation, you can do so by joining KSK on Facebook. You can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, Line 1 is going to return as we address some medical or mental health issues and talk about sexuality and intimacy in relationships with local therapists Rebecca Love and Chris Reynolds. So why not tune in and learn more Monday, September 23rd at 2 p.m. on 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is our chief contact officer here at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt was our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.